And there you have some of the music that Jacques Offenbach wrote for the Jules Verne production, From the Earth to the Moon, Dance of the Snowflakes, and things like that, which did not sound very much like science fiction, but indeed in 1875 it very much was. And that was the National Philharmonic with Richard Bonning conducting. Well, speaking of conductors and performers, George Takei is in our studio with me this morning, and welcome. Pleasure to have you here.
Good to be here.
And you'll be is the word narrating that you're going to be doing with the Milwaukee Symphony this weekend?
Well, actually, in the first act, there's only a brief narration, but a lot of me just talking about Star Trek. The narration is the prologue from TV episodes of Star Trek. Space, the Final Frontier, that one. The second act is where we do Klaatu's final speech from the film The Day the Earth Stood Still.
Sure, 1950 classic.
Exactly, and the music by Bernard Herrmann. So that's playing behind me as I recite this alien who comes to Earth and is immediately shot at and imprisoned. Michael Rennie, yes. And that was our reaction to anything alien, anything different coming into our society. And so it's again, a metaphor for a lot of other contemporary issues.
Well, as one who grew up in Los Angeles and had that childhood interrupted by being relocated in one of those Japanese-American internment camps, that must be a theme that is a running current in your life.
The word relocated, as you know, is a euphemism.
Yes.
I remember that morning when I was 5 years old. My parents got us up early, my younger brother and our baby sister got us dressed, and my brother and I were in the living room, and I was looking out the front window, and I saw two soldiers come marching up our driveway with bayonets on their rifles, and they stomped up the front porch and banged on the door, and my father answered it, and the soldiers ordered us out of our own home. And I remember seeing my mother come out from the back, carrying my baby sister and carrying a huge duffel bag on the other arm and tears streaming down her cheek. I'll never forget that. You know, when you see your mother crying like that, it's something that's seared into your memory. And then we were taken from there to a nearby racetrack.
Santa Anita.
And taken to the horse stalls and told that we were to spend the next few months in the horse stalls, because the camps had not been built yet. While they were being constructed, we would stay there in that stinky horse stall.
How did your parents explain to you what was going on? Did you have any warning?
My father told us that we were going for a long vacation, and it was a few months after we were living there in the horse stalls, that he said we were going to a place called Arkansas. And for me, as a kid, you know, vacation meant fun. And Arkansas sounded exotic. And so I was excited and looking forward to it. And I thought everyone went on vacations in long trains with armed soldiers at both ends of the car, and with some people that were very glum. But I was excited. I was going to Arkansas for a vacation.
There is a terrible irony in the incarceration of your family, in that not only were you solidly American, but actually you're named after King George VI of England, your father and you, both Anglophiles.
My father was an Anglophile. I was born in 1937, the year of the coronation of George VI. And so hence, I'm George. When my brother was born, he was round and fat and roly-poly, as fat as Henry VIII. So guess what his name is? We're named after English royalty.
We'll be back more with George Takei and that after some music, more science fiction music here on Wisconsin Public Radio. It's going to be, in this case, from 1955 and a film called Things to Come. It's music by Arthur Bliss, which includes such things as The Building of the New World, Machines, Attack of the Moon Gun. And we may even get to the epilogue. And then back with my guest today, George Takei. And you've been listening to some of the things to come. That's music of Sir Arthur Bliss for the 1955 film, including The Attack on the Moon Gun. How's that for a good classical music blend with science fiction? I'm Norman Gilliland, back with George Takei, and more from him in his early years. In fact, we'll even talk about Lieutenant Sulu and Star Trek right after this on Wisconsin Public Radio. Back with George Takei, and we're talking about parents. And so your father, Norman Takei, was first-generation American or second? Or
he was first. He was born in Japan, but he was brought to San Francisco by my paternal grandfather when he was 8 or 9. And so he was reared in San Francisco, educated in San Francisco, and his heart was American. My mother was born in Sacramento. We say Sacramento, actually a small farming community near Sacramento called Florin. My maternal grandparents came from Japan, and they settled in Florin, in the Sacramento Delta, and my mother and all her siblings were born there.
But you spent once the war was over and you came back from the internment camp, then you went back to the Los Angeles area?
That's correct. Many people were embittered by their... Most Japanese-American before the war were on the West Coast. And it was the West Coast Japanese-Americans that were incarcerated. Isn't that silly? Hawaii was a place that was bombed. Hawaii had the most Japanese Americans. I think almost half the population was Japanese American. They didn't intern people from Hawaii, the West Coast, because we were more vulnerable. If they incarcerated the Japanese Americans of Hawaii, the economy would have collapsed.
Well, yeah, they were too dependent upon them, sure.
And we had farmland that people had their eyes on. There was an economic reason as well. And so we were taken away and put in these barbed wire internment camps in some of the most godforsaken places in the country. Can you imagine the blistering hot desert of Arizona in the summertime? I mean, you complain about your Milwaukee summers. You know, this is paradise compared to the desert of Arizona. We were sent to the sultry swamps of southeastern Arkansas, and there were two internment camps there. Others were up in the high plains, cold, windswept, dust storm plagued areas like Wyoming, Idaho, Utah, Colorado, and there were two in the most desolate places in California. And everything was taken from us. And when we came back to Los Angeles, the hatred was still intense. Jobs were difficult. Housing was well-nigh impossible. Our first home was on Skid Row in downtown Los Angeles. We had a two-bedroom house before the war. And, you know, because we were so young, I remember the barbed wire fence and the sentry towers with the machine guns pointed at us. And when I made the night runs to the latrine, searchlights followed me. But they became normality. In fact, I thought it was kind of nice that they lit the way for me to pee, you know. everybody else I knew in camp lived the same way. We lined up three times a day to eat in a noisy mess hall. You know, we went to mass showers. And a stinging irony for me now, We began the school day with the Pledge of Allegiance to the flag. I could see the barbed wire fence and the sentry tower right outside my schoolhouse window as I recited the words very innocently, with liberty and justice for all. But when we returned, that's when we realized what internment meant. I was 8 years old by that time, and the stench of Skid Row, urine everywhere, on the street, on the in the hallways, those scary people lined up leaning against the wall, smelly, ugly, you know, reeking with all sorts of smells. And, you know, my baby sister said, "Mama, let's go back home," meaning behind barbed wires, because
it was better than Skid Row.
Safer. It was normality for us.
You, pretty early on, got into Hollywood-related activities. You were involved, as we mentioned, with Rodin and making that English-language version of the Japanese classic, but not because you're fluent in Japanese. You're fluent in Spanish, too. But not too long after that, you were in Playhouse 90, which was one of the great TV shows, live TV shows. Was do you think, especially exciting doing live television?
It was thrilling just to be cast in that. I was addicted to Playhouse 90. You know, it was something that was, to me, far away. It was one of these great landmark shows, great playwrights, Patty Chayefsky, Reginald Rose, Rod Serling, you know, wonderful dramas and wonderful actors, Geraldine Page, Jack Palance in Requiem for a Heavyweight, you know, wonderful dramas.
Classic. That was Rod Serling.
Rod Serling, yes. And I was plucked out from theaters, the student production at UCLA, and plunked into my first paying gig.
You didn't have to do any boxing, did you, in Requiem for a Heavyweight?
No, I wasn't. Mine was called Made in Japan. Uh-huh. I played a Japanese soldier, but I get a suicide scene.
Oh, it's that's dramatic.
Another chewy hunk of red meat.
You seem pretty much to have had the niche there. I mean, there weren't many Japanese American actors who really rose to prominence in the profession.
Well, there were not many Asian American actors. There were many that went out and sold their faces as extras,
sure,
as waiters or as.
I have a poem about that, by the way. I can't resist bringing it in at this time.
Well, an author should not resist like that.
I wish you could read it, but you haven't seen it yet. So
no,
it goes
I have
like
not.
This. Many actors at best will appear in a crowd with one line and a spear, but few carry the play like the star George Takei. So congrats on your Sulu career.
Well, how flattering. Thank you very much. There were many Asian faces, but they weren't actors who came up with ideas of their own, who had suggestions to make.
Ongoing characters.
So that, as you say, it gave me a niche. But at the same time, I'm grateful that I had the kind of parents I had, because Asian American parents of my parents' generation, not only did not encourage their children if they had talent, they actually discouraged them from going into the arts because we were insecure. They wanted their children to be
kind
the classic
mainstream
things, doctors, mm-hmm, engineers, professors, all those good, distinguished, respectable, and upper middle class areas. And their children going into music or writing or acting in the arts, God forbid, they're going to starve. I'm going to support them for the rest of their lives.
A lot of them did, didn't they?
I was a theater student. My minor was Latin American studies. My father said, I have a useless minor and a hopeless major. I'm going to be supporting you for the rest of your life. But, well, I showed him.
Well, a bad major led to a great lieutenant. And how did 1966 come about? How did you become Lieutenant Sulu?
Well, I had my list of credits by that time. My very first gig was in 57. And so, you know, I was a working actor. And one day I was called in for an interview with this man named Gene Roddenberry, whom I didn't know from Adam. I walked in, and he usually when they're interviewing actors for a series, they have a whole battery of people, you know, the network people, the studio people.
Just enough to be really intimidating.
You know, and they're all sober-faced and they're glaring at you. And some will, you know, the good cop, bad cop, you know, some will smile occasionally or chuckle when you say something witty. But when I went in for the interview with Gene Roddenberry, he was the only one. So that in itself was unusual. And then he, rather than having the desk between us, he indicated the sofa, kind of an L-shaped sofa. And we sat there, and it was I remember it as a very unusual interview. We talked about current events, our thoughts on it, movies we'd seen, books that particularly impressed us. And then he explained
the role,
idea of the show itself, and then my role. And he really tantalized me. I really wanted to, you know, get cast. But then he thanked me for coming in, and I was out. And I thought, was that it? Maybe he didn't want me, but he was just being polite by making social chit-chat, you know. He's a nice man, and I'd love to have done this series. But I reported that to my agent. And when I didn't hear for about 2 weeks, and I kept calling my agent during those 2 weeks, have we heard from them yet? Have we heard? And he said, no, we haven't. And I thought, well, I guess that's it. But then my agent called one morning and said, I was cast. I was blown away by that. But
without an audition, you mean? I mean, without reading any lines.
Without
or anything.
Reading. Apparently, he did his homework. He'd seen my work, and he wanted to. I found out that the other actors were similarly interviewed. He wanted to know what made us tick, what kind of, what our interests were, what we thought of current events, because it was a show that addressed issues of our time.
Sure, very much so.
Very much. And so his casting style was very unique, and that's what helped build that chemistry that apparently we had, that they told us we had.
But it still took Sulu how long to get promoted from? it wasn't until about 1991 or something like that in one of the movies, right?
I had to lobby hard. I lobbied all through, while we were on the TV series, I lobbied for more for Sulu to do, you know, beyond Sir Warp 3.
Well,
steady
right.
As she
yeah,
goes.
Yeah, and so did you get it? How much input did you actually have?
I gave him a lot of input.
But, how much came out?
Well, when you have seven regular performers, three who are the principals,
sure,
it's pretty difficult. You know, you give them all the ideas, but they're all doing the same thing. Even Bill and Leonard were, you know, kind of elbowing each other for their
more lines, more stuff.
Time in the spotlight, you know. And so with the TV series, it was a little difficult. But when we heard that we're going to be a feature film, I thought, how wonderful. But, you know, that was that. But then we heard that there was a sequel going to be made. They weren't intending on making a sequel, but because the first film did so well, they decided to do a sequel. And that's when I thought, well, I'll do a little lobbying. And I invited the producer and the director to have lunch at a very fine Little Tokyo restaurant overlooking a Japanese garden, and lobbied them. Starfleet is supposed to be a meritocracy, and if it's a meritocracy, you know, there should be advances.
Yes.
And eventually, so they started giving us new titles. But I was still at the same console doing the exact same thing I was doing as a lieutenant in the TV series and in the first movie.
Did you get a better uniform anyway?
We did get a better uniform.
Upgrades there.
Because in the first film, Star Trek The Motion Picture, they had us in a one-piece spandex outfit with even the shoes attached, you know. And it zipped up the back and went under the armpit and so forth, you know. Grown men and women, organic creatures, animals who hydrate and need to dehydrate.
On a long shoot.
Couldn't go to the dehydration chamber without our dressers following us. And we had to wiggle out of this spandex uniform to answer Mother Nature's call. And so when they said they're going to do a sequel, we all went on a strike. We said we will not come back unless we get a fly in our costume. And thus the uniform that you see in 2, 3, 4, and 6.
And we'll be back with George Takei in just a moment here on Wisconsin Public Radio. Back with George Takei, and you're listening to us on Wisconsin Public Radio. George Takei is in Milwaukee, which is where we're broadcasting from this morning, and he will be the narrator with the Milwaukee Symphony for 3 concerts this weekend, Friday night and Saturday night at 8, and Sunday afternoon at 2:30. It's a sci-fi spectacular with music from, let's see, well, could be Star Trek even in there.
Star Trek, Star Wars,
E.T.,
The Day the Earth Stood Still, the whole panorama.
I've heard that when the first Star Trek movie came out, it was right about the time, was it not, that Star Wars came out? And there was some kind of reconfiguring. They said, oh, okay, I think we better kind of upgrade a little bit.
Well, Star Wars came out before we became a series of movies. Our ratings were very low when we were on television. We were near the cellar all 3 seasons.
I know, that's hard to believe, isn't it?
It's hard to believe, but I guess we were before our time. And so they had the numbers to justify cancellation. But it was after we were canceled and we went into syndication that the ratings soared. And so we had many announcements of when we would be coming back as a television series again.
Oh, really?
I remember February of 1974 was one date that it was the first date we were given. And I remember that because we were so excited about it. But as we got nearer February, then they started kind of hedging, and that kept getting pushed back. And then the next date was 75, and then 76. And then Star Wars hit, and that's when the green head of greed arose at the executive offices at Paramount, and they decided to do us as a feature film. And that's what gave birth to our first film, Star Trek The Motion Picture. So it was, we actually followed in the footsteps of Star Wars. We are a result of Star Wars' success.
You had a favorite episode of Star Trek, the series. Is that the one with the bare chest?
The one with the sword.
Yes, uh-huh.
I get unleashed from that damn console at long last. And, rip my shirt off and grab my fencing foil and terrorize the ship.
The idea being that there was some kind of virus that got into the ship that made everybody lose their
inhibitions,
yes. Now, if you had crafted a role for Sulu, if you had been able to write and direct one of those episodes, what kind of episode would it have been?
Well, Sulu would have been much more rounded and dimensioned. He would have parents, which, and those were ideas that I suggested.
It took you a while just to get a first name, didn't it?
First name, yes. I think didn't happen until the movies. throughout the three seasons, I was just Mr. Sulu. But I would give him parents. I would give him a love interest, if not already married, maybe having children, you know, to make him more fully a human. But, you know, Kirk, too, had went for a long time without a family as well.
That's true. So you did develop eventually a backstory for Sulu?
Mm-hmm. I did.
And what kind of story, what kind of background did he have?
Well, he was born in San Francisco, which was my father's hometown. And you make that discovery in Star Trek IV, The Undiscovered. No, Star Trek IV, The Voyage Home. He has a scene where he says, "San Francisco, I was born there." And that was also the headquarters of Starfleet Command. He was San Franciscan. And this was an idea I have to give proper credit to Harv Bennett. He was the producer of Star Trek IV. And he came up with the idea of having a ancestor of mine. You know, we go back in time to the 20th century. And my meeting a young Asian kid, a young, I think he was 7 or 8, boy, on the streets of San Francisco, and discover that he's his great-great-great-grandfather to be.
Uh-huh.
It was a charming scene. But unfortunately, they cast a young boy who tested wonderfully in a cool, calm, collected office building where they videotaped a scene with him. He was absolutely charming. And Leonard, who was directing that film, cast him in it. And he didn't get a backup young boy. And the boy that he had cast froze up on location on the streets of San Francisco with these big lights being trundled about and being put into wardrobe and makeup patting his face, and he just froze.
Does that happen often?
Well, when you have, you know, a child, and when you have a rank amateur, and you put him in an absolutely terrifying situation, it happens. And we lost that scene. We spent a whole half a day trying to cajole that kid into doing. In fact, Leonard, who was dressed as Mr. Spock in that that horsehair gown, was hunkering down. And he said, "You like Uncle Sulu, don't you? You think he's funny, don't you?"
Oh, I wish I had film of that.
We have still shots of that, alas, we didn't have the camera going.
We're hearing a little bit of The Day the Earth Stood Still underneath our conversation. And it makes me wonder, were you a reader at all of science fiction, or other than Rodan that you worked on, were you an appreciator, a connoisseur of science fiction films growing up?
To be honest, I was not. I had read Ray Bradbury, but I didn't fancy myself as a sci-fi fan. And it wasn't until I got cast in Star Trek and I started meeting some of our writers, like Harlan Ellison, who's a dear friend. And, you know, he's an incredible ideas guy and a very strongly, fiercely opinionated guy.
Well, that can be good.
That was good. But some people found it very off-putting because he is so intense. But other much more mild-mannered people like Ted Sturgeon Norm Spinrad, who are, you know, so imaginative and have such penetrating thoughts on our contemporary society that I started saying, you know, there's something to this thing called science fiction, and I started reading more.
Did you ever do any other science fiction roles other than Sulu?
Yes. I did, Peter David, who was a wonderful science fiction writer, and he's written many sci-fi or Star Trek novels, did a television series in Canada aimed at preteens. and I played an alien creature who was an irregular on that series.
Recognizable, though, at least as...
No. I was totally unrecognizable, save for my voice.
Oh, so it's
it
almost...
was my voice, but I was completely covered in rubber.
Well, you have the advantage of a very distinctive voice, so at least you'd be recognized in any event, even do, you know, animation. Well, you do some animation, too,
I do.
Don't you?
And that's why I was cast in... what was the character's name? I can't remember the... I played him regularly, but it was like in 1980 or thereabouts, so I can't remember the character.
And now, you know, some of these things, as we said, which were fiction 50, 60 years ago is reality, and that would include something like the Internet, which I understand you are almost omnipresent on the Internet in one format or another.
It is an amazing medium for communication. We've been developing a musical, Bound for Broadway, on the internment of Japanese Americans. It's a factual story, but fictional. The events are all factual. We take a fictional family and put this family in the Wyoming camp, Heart Mountain. And it is a story of the loss and the heartbreak, but also of heroism and tremendous determination to prevail. And so it's ultimately an uplifting story. But because of that, the nature of that story, we thought we needed to... first of all, have people understand that dark chapter of American history and to get the word out on our musical allegiance. And so I thought, you know, this would be a wonderful... Facebook would be a wonderful way to get that going. People are still... there are so many people that tell me, I had no idea something like the internment happened in the United States. Innocent citizens with no charges and no trial being imprisoned for no good reason than that we looked like the people at Bomb Pearl Harbor. And so I did that as a preliminary word out about allegiance. And I thought I sprinkled it with a little humor and a few kiddies. It grew and grew and grew to the point where, you know, we were nearing 1 million. And then we went past 1 million, and now we're over 2 million. It's just amazing. And so we're trying to use it as educationally, but as using fun and photos to get people to... checking up on us daily.
And I suppose, unlike back in the days of Star Trek, you get immediate response, interaction with the users.
It's amazing. It is really a remarkable system, which is now undergoing some transition. As we all know, Facebook is in need of raising some revenue.
That didn't do so well with the stock offering, did they?
They have people that invested in it, and they want to start making money. And so it seems to be going through some evolution.
Sure.
And it's puzzling us because we've been growing consistently. And suddenly, you know, our growth is not only plateauing out, but, you know, some people are not getting what we put on a post.
Oh, really?
And so, and they've...
Are you maxing out the system or what?
No, they have approached us and said, if you want to reach more people, we might enhance it by paying some revenue. I think they're testing out a lot of ideas.
Oh, sure.
We're not going to do that because, you know, we want it... explain why, you know, were we growing like this, and suddenly you're stepping in and doing something to control that growth unnaturally.
Yes. Well, that's probably true of so many media innovations, wouldn't it be? I mean, if you go back to the printing press, it's suddenly, oh, well, why should we restrict what we print? Because as soon as you have the first thing printed, then people have all kinds of ideas as to how that medium should be used. Certainly true of broadcasting, too.
We are entering into a brave new world, and that's what's exciting, to be part of that, to be, you know, getting the impact of that, quote, evolution, and having a role to play in giving some shape and form. And, you know, it's reasonable. I think they need to make money. They most certainly, Zuckerman has a lot of money already.
Well, in the next couple of minutes, do you have any notions of doing more film?
Well, we hope that Allegiance is such a success that we get productions in London, Toronto, Tokyo, and ultimately maybe a movie. I have a lot of ideas in mind. As I said, I wrote an autobiography, and I've lived a lot.
Yeah, that's been out for a while, right?
It came out in 1994, and I've lived a lot of material since then.
I hope you're taking careful notes.
Up here, in my mind. And so I'm toying with the idea of another autobiography. And this internet success that I've been blessed with, that might be a subject for a little humorous tome.
So you wouldn't be in a position to go back and talk one-on-one to a producer and pitch an idea or pitch yourself for a character? I mean, those days are behind you?
Oh, no. I'm certainly game for that. When Allegiance has proven itself on Broadway, we may engage in that kind of pitch effort with Hollywood studio heads or development heads, and see if we can nudge Allegiance along into a movie version.
Do you have other than the Star Trek movies? Do you have a favorite film or two that inspired you in your formative years in terms of, you know, the acting or the production?
I did a play in New York called The Year of the Dragon, written by a Chinese American, Frank Chin, about a family, a Chinese American family in Chinatown. You know, that's Rodgers and Hammerstein depicted as a exotic, charming, fun place. Actually, it's a ghetto, and there's a lot of poverty and a lot of cultural struggle, cultural wrestling going on in families. It was a drama that I could bring some of my own personal life experiences too. And then we taped it for television on the Theater in America series for PBS, as a matter of NPR, as a matter of fact.
Oh, good for you.
And I feel that that's been one of the soul-fulfilling projects that I've done. But we'll see how Allegiance goes, because that's been my... I've been calling that my legacy project.
Well, we'll hope to have you maybe do some radio, even some radio drama one of these days. That would be fun.
Yeah, I grew up on radio, you know, Green Hornet, Cisco Kid. And there's something wonderful about creating a whole world, a whole civilization, and maybe a whole fascinating person. Just with your voice, with sound. It's a whole another medium.
Well, thanks for joining us on this medium today, George Takei. And we've had a little bit of science fiction-oriented music in the background there as a effect. And we'll look forward to your performances this weekend. Thanks again.
Thank you very much. I look forward to meeting all my Milwaukee fans here during the sci-fi concerts.